episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace. This episode is the long interview I did with comic illustrator Chuck Patton at Long Beach Comic Con. Chuck is probably most known these days for actually his work in animation, both as a concept artist, animator, director. He's pretty much done it all in the world of animation these days, but I actually first discovered him as the penciler on Justice League. Specifically remember, it was issue 221. It was the beginning of a three-part storyline about these kind of half-human, half-beast sort of hybrid people that were having like these gladiator games. And I just remember the art totally blew me away. He did quite a few issues of Justice League in the early 80s. And for me, it just hit me like at just the right time. Chuck's art has a little bit of the look of Jose Luis Garcia Lopez to me. And so for that reason, being a kid of the 80s, Garcia Lopez art was everywhere on every piece of merchandise you could possibly find, from superpower toys to bed sheets to lunch pails to t-shirts. It was just everywhere. And so, in my youth, not realizing that there were, all these different creators behind different books and such, I can remember collecting all these comics and not even being cognizant of the fact that they were, I know they kind of looked different. They didn't all look exactly the same. But not even, thinking about the artists, and now being such a huge comic fan and knowing all these creators, it kind of boggles my mind. But Chuck's art reminded me of Garcia Lopez's art, to the point where following Justice League and reading the book month in and month out and looking at that art, to me, the way those characters looked, the way that Chuck drew Superman, was the way Superman was supposed to look. The way he drew Flash, Hawkman, Firestorm, Wonder Woman, Batman, those were the prototypical ways that those heroes were supposed to look. And I remember being so into Justice League at the time and reading some of those books, especially that three-part story with the Beast Men, until the covers were falling off the books. But I just remember reading them over and over and over, to the point where later, as my taste started to change and I started to branch out more, and I would see other artists takes their versions on these classic heroes, and I would remember thinking at the time, well, that's not exactly how they're supposed to look. They're supposed to look how they look in the Justice League book, like the way Chuck Patton draws them, not realizing, just that's the way they're supposed to be drawn. I wasn't cognizant that it was Chuck Patton's art. So for me, just an icon in the industry as far as the look of those characters at that time. So it was great to meet Chuck and to talk with him. He was super generous with his time, giving us kind of his secret origin, how he broke in to comics, and how he was discouraged in a way, and that led him into the world of animation, where he's thrived. He's done some incredible things in animation, from Spawn to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to Captain Planet, and he's a great, great guy. I held this interview with him first thing on Sunday at the convention, and I went back later on Sunday to pick up my commission, because I got him to do a commission for me in my Justice League themed sketchbook. And he asked me about my take on the Cyborg Rebirth title that John Semper Jr. is writing for DC right now. And man, we had another good 20-30 minute talk about Detroit and the things that John is doing, because you'll hear Chuck talk about it in the interview, about how he grew up reading DC comics, and he's still a comic fan to this day. He still reads a lot of books, and so he just wanted my take on what my thoughts were. So it was great. Like I said, he's a comic fan first and foremost. Great guy to talk to. It was a pleasure to meet him. I can't wait to run into him again and get another commission, actually. So if you have the chance, he's a great guy to talk to. I definitely recommend getting a commission from him. He's one of the really, really good guys out there. And it was a pleasure talking to him. So I hope you all enjoy the interview. As I said, he was very generous with his time. So we did talk for almost an hour. So this is going to be a long one, guys. But it's definitely worth it. Very informative and just a whole heck of a lot of fun. So thanks for listening, everybody. Hope you enjoy the interview. And we'll talk to you next time.
All right, this is Jace from The Comic Source, presented by LRM Media. I'm here with comic illustrator, animator, Chuck Patton. How you doing, Chuck?
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, man, it's going good. It's great to sit down and talk to you.
Oh, thank you.
I was telling Manny, one of my co-hosts, just yesterday, that Chuck Patton, I'm not that familiar. He hasn't been reading comics anywhere near as long as me. I was like, you know, I remember my first Justice League comic I ever picked up.
Oh, my God.
It was you. It was your
comic. Oh, man.
When I was young. And so for me, I followed, I was hooked immediately. I thought the art was great. Loved the story.
Oh, thank you.
So for me, growing up, that's what the characters were supposed to look like.
Oh, dude. Thank you. Thank you.
And it was great. So
thank
I wonder
you.
If, for some of our listeners that might not be that familiar, if you could give us a brief history.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Chuck Patton, how, your run on Justice League.
Yeah.
What you've been doing recently. All that good stuff.
Okay. Long story short, I've been a lifelong comic book fan. I was just telling somebody I learned how to read from comic strips. My mom taught me when I was 3 to 4 to read off of newspaper strips.
Okay.
Particularly, I learned from Prince Valiant and Tarzan.
All right.
Which probably is why, for this day, those are my two favorites. So I drew comics on everything. I was drawing to the point where the family just threw up their hands. Anything that was blank paper, I would draw on. So they started buying me tablets, and from there I was comic book bound. Flash forward as an adult, I had trained. I was learning to be a journalist because my mom was worried that, this comic book business, they don't pay money, right?
Right.
Because this is during the 70s, so we didn't even know humans actually did comics. Thanks to Marvel, they told us guys, were the artists. And so I learned to be a journalist, learned to write. And so I was pushing towards that as my major as I entered college. And I just had an epiphany one night because I love comics and I had friends around me who would talk comics and I knew more than they did. And I can draw, which kind of put me on a certain level where it's like, why are you doing this other stuff? And I finally went, you're right. I'm gonna try. And so I went out and before the internet and hustled and talked to people and networked to where I finally met Keith Pollard, who was actually lived in my hometown of Detroit. It's weird to call Detroit a hometown because if you've ever been to Detroit, it's anything but a town. But it was a township outside Detroit where I met Keith. And Keith was gracious to give me an afternoon of just schooling me on what I needed to do. And he was very, 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 very encouraging to my work. Because again, this is before the internet. There was, unless you apprentice under a comic artist, there was no schools, no classes, nothing. None of the accredited art schools were recognized even a comic book as an art. I had to go into commercial art when I switched my major, so I can at least learn graphic arts and how to apply what I was learning at home to a so-called business. So anyway, Keith pointed me to certain people. I talked to certain other people, like Arvell Jones, other artists from Detroit. I've talked to Terry Austin briefly once. And then I just made the trek. That was what he told me. It was like, you gotta get out of town. You gotta get out of Detroit. You're never, you're not gonna learn it from here. You gotta go there. And so it took 3 years, but I made it to New York and got caught by caught the eye of Dick Giordano, who was starting New Talent Showcase. The book was Showcase, but it was called the New Talent Program. And there was 30 of us. And by the first month, it was down to 15 of us.
Wow.
And by the second or third week, it was just down to 12. of people who either dropped out or luckily got work. I think one of the guys who got work before me was Kim DeMolder, who was in my class. There are other people I won't mention because it won't sound flattering, but there was this one guy who was a little cocky and he got work from Marvel and he thought we were beneath him. And I remember Ernie Colon was lecturing the class and he was like, well, is there any advice you want to ask me? Now this is Ernie Colon, who had drawn everything from Casper to Hot Stuff and he was making his resurgence into superhero stuff, but Ernie has the chops. Ernie could draw his butt off. This is a guy with 30 something years experience and this kid had the nerve to go, well, I got a $50 $100 gift certificate for my grandmother. What should I spend it on? And I was thinking of how much I went through to get there, and this little ass, who again, name I won't mention, who today I look at his work and I still feel kind of like, you're a putz, but you'll always be a putz, but and that's mean, but I'll tell you now, I've gotten a little more gritty in my old age,
yeah.
But I remember looking at that and going, man, you just, this was a life, this was a lifestyle, this was a goal that I had in my dream, in my, a gleam in my eye. And I thought everybody there who got there, even the ones who passed out, what a great opportunity we had.
Right.
And some of us, like myself, didn't think I was going to make it. I didn't think I was going to be that good. Dick really was a tough teacher, and he went out of his way to... He was also the nicest guy in the world, but Dick can really get you and motivate you and let you know if you weren't doing well. And his favorite line was, wow, you went out of your way to be boring. And whenever he say that, it used to just crush me inside, having no idea that he was building me up to take criticism. Because I was in it for about 4 or 5 months of strenuous going there once a week. We put 4 hours in once a week to learn comics, how to draw comics. And one day, there used to be this ritual. If you weren't doing so well, Dick would pull you out of the room and you wouldn't see the other person again. Or if you're lucky, he'll pull you out of the other room and you'd be working somewhere. But I got pulled out of the room and I thought, oh geez, that's it, I'm getting kicked out. Except I wasn't going towards the exit or the entrance, I was going into the inner offices, which none of us were allowed to go in.
Right.
So I was getting nervous, like, oh geez, he's taking me to the back rooms to really chew me out. And he walked me into this beautiful office where Len Wein and Marv Wolfman and George Perez were working on Titans. And I'm like, they were like, hey kid, you're looking good, you know, Dick really talks highly. And he goes, Dick? And Dick takes that time to go, okay, he's in your hands, I'm out of here. And he leaves me there, and I'm stunned, like, what the hell is going on? And they sit me down and go, well, listen, Dick talks about you highly. He says you're the fastest guy in the group, that you grab, you know, you draw well, that da 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 da. And I'm thinking, no, he says I'm boring. No, he really says that all the time. He goes, he says that, but he says you're the guy to help us because we're behind on this book. And by that time George had left, he shook my hand and said, yeah, I love your work, I've seen what you're doing, you're going to be great. And I'm shocked because I had no idea no one had seen my work other than Dick and maybe Ernie Colon, who was a co-teacher on this thing. And Lynn says, I have this book that's late, and it's so late. And what do you think of Brave and the Bold? Now, I've been a DC fan all my life. In our house, growing up, we read every damn comic book out there. My sisters, my mom, were that avid, so I was lucky. I didn't have parents. I mean, my mom threw away my comics later and then realized, yeah, oh my God, I threw away a fortune. But she was very encouraging. So we had everything from Gold Key Comics to Dell Comics to DC Comics, very little Marvels, because Marvel didn't distribute well in my area.
Right.
So it was really hard to get a Marvel comic. The only Marvel comic you can get your hands on was Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Thor, which I liked, was really hard to get. But anyway, I was always a diehard DC character. I mean, I read and knew every damn DC character, which was another impressive thing. That Dick was like, this guy really likes DC. So Lynn goes, yeah, Dick says you know some stuff. So what do you think about Brave and the Bold? And he goes, well, I love Brave and the Bold. Are you crazy? And this is just when Brave and the Bold became, well, it started in the 70s as it went from being this sort of roundhouse book to Batman oriented. It was
right.
Batman and someone.
Right.
And I love those. Jim Aparo, I ate those things up. So I'm like, oh, I love this book. Love the book. And I don't think Aparo was doing it. I think he was going on to something else because Gene Day was drawing the book. And Lynn went, well, what do you think of Gene Day's work? And I went, well, he's good. And he goes, now, what do you really think? And that was how Lynn was. Lynn would probe. And I went, well, you know, I think Gene's a little dependent on photographs. I really wish he'd just draw on his own, but I know every damn photo reference he was using. And then, yeah, he kind of does that, you know. Well, he died. And I went, oh, my God. Because, yeah, he died. He died on the drawing table. And I went, oh, my God. Because, yeah, he had a heart attack. And he was working on this book. Now, I'm in the shock of hearing Gene Day die, and I just badmouthed him. And I'm a good Baptist kid. I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to hell for this. I didn't really mean it, Mr. Day. And I'm hearing Lynn going, yeah, I want you to take over the book. I want you to take that issue over. And I stop and go, you want me to draw over Gene Day? He goes, no, I want you to pick up where Gene never got that far. I need you to pick the book up, the issue up, I keep saying the book, but it was only one issue. You take this issue and you draw it, you know, from beginning to end. You've got 2 weeks to rough and 2 weeks to tighten it up and get it to us. And I was working a really crappy job in Long Island City doing frames, which is why today I can't deal with frames. I'm a framer. For 5 years prior to that, that's all I did was frames to support being an artist. And I went, yeah, but I kept my day job. So I went home at night and drew to 3 a.m. and then showed up at 9 the next morning at my job. And after the first week, Ernie Colon was put on as my editor. And Ernie calls up and goes, hey kid, where are you on the book? I'm like, I'm still behind. I'm only 5 pages in. He goes, you got 2 weeks. You don't have time for that shit. Why are you taking so long? And I'm freaking out. And I goes, because I have a job. He goes, no, you dummy. You already got a job. You work for DC Comics. And I had this, it was one of those moments in your life when you realize, damn right, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he goes, you're a DC artist, damn it. You go in there and quit that job. You got job. So I'm getting paid? He goes, yes, you're getting paid. Because I thought this was all for free. Seriously, no one explained all this to me. So I remember going to the office going, I quit. He goes, you can't quit. You got to resign. He goes, give me a piece of paper. I resign. I've never done that. I saw it in a movie. I did it. The bosses, the supervisor were all freaked out because most of the people who took those jobs didn't last long anyway. So you're desperate to have it. And here I'm going, no, screw you. I've hit it, man. I'm going, I got my dream job. Screw you. I resign. And I went home and drew nonstop, 72 hours, got the book done, turned it in. They loved it. Tightened it up within 2 days. I didn't even tighten it up. Actually, it was all tightened up. So I actually drew the book in about 3 weeks.
Wow.
And they loved it. And I was numb. And then I saw the first check, and that was the first time I received money that large as a kid. I mean, I came to New York with one suitcase. I lived on someone's floor for the first week, on their kitchen floor for the first week I was in New York. Slept in someone else's place, their middle room for 4 months. So here all of a sudden, I got the dream job. And as soon as I turned in Brave and the Bold, Lynn goes, Don Heck wants to leave Justice League. We need a new artist.
Wow.
We want you, fresh blood, on this thing. And
being a huge DC fan, that had to be like, my God.
That was the holy fucking grail. Honestly, it was the holy grail. I'm sorry I used the colorful language, but it was the holy fucking grail. I remember calling my family up and telling them. And my sisters all stayed cautious about me ever achieving anything, because as they told me later, we didn't want to discourage you if you fail. It's like, well, you know, I've learned later, you need to fail so you achieve something. And even when I got it, the excitement was there, but there was still that cautious thing. You sure you got this job? You sure that check didn't bounce? You sure you gonna do this all the time? And I got Justice League, and that was an amazing thing. And then after that, this roller coaster happened where, yeah, you got Justice League, you got the book you always wanted to draw, the characters you always drawn. I mean, I was so looking forward to Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, yeah. Aquaman. And then I was told, well, we're taking Batman out of the book. Jim is going to be doing a new book called Batman the Outsider, so Batman's leaving Justice League. Oh, okay. What about Superman and Wonder Woman? We're going to be taking them out of the book too, eventually. So I'm like, oh my God. So you got like less than a year to draw these guys. But here's our problem. Jerry Conway isn't writing the book anymore regularly. He wants to kind of get off. Yeah, he's not sure where he wants to write comics or not. And he had other comics, but he wasn't sure. He had written Justice League for over 10 years. So he was kind of burnt out. And he was also kind of discouraged that they were changing the roster. And I'm a rookie. I'm already just, wow, I replaced Gene Day. Now I'm getting to draw Batman and Karate Kid and Brave and the Bold. Now I'm drawing Justice League. Oh man, am I getting Superman, Wonder Woman? And all of a sudden I get these fill-in stories with Superman, Wonder Woman, no Batman. But it was a really weird mixed moment of excitement and sort of fear, because I didn't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I didn't know that we're going to do this new twist. They talked to a lot of writers who all thought, yeah, Justice League, and then they all got discouraged and went, yeah, Justice League without the big guys aren't Justice League. Because it's not like the Avengers, where they can bring on a character like Hawkeye and he'll grow into, right. You know. And I think we even batted around saying, okay, let's bring Green Arrow in. And again, I think there was a weird burnout on that book. Lynn, God bless him as the editor, kept the energy up around it, but a lot of the outside writers who were of note didn't want to jump on except one guy, and that was J.M. DeMatteis. And he and I had a talk where he was like, you know, I like what you do, you draw a lot of faces and I like that and I want to come on the book. So I got excited. I wasn't a huge fan of him, but I was respectful that this is a guy of note, so he's going to bring something on here. And he didn't really know what he wanted to do. So, but I was, okay, you're going to teach me as we go along. Well, JM decided at the last minute that he wasn't ready. So we're back in this no zone of who's going to write it. So I went through a slew of different writers on the book, my first few books. Actually, we did get one Justice League Jerry Conway script that I loved. It was violent as hell. Actually, Jerry was trying to pare it back, and I talked everybody into pushing it forward. And that was the Beast storyline.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was actually going to be my first Justice League, but we actually put that script on the back shelf when I started for a good 4 months until Jerry decided he wanted to do something. He picked the script back up. By that time, Lynn and I had went in and Lynn was really, really had taught me so much about storytelling in that brief time together, where he showed me what it was to be an editor. He would bounce ideas off me all the time. I learned a lot from him and Marv on how to deal with stories in that 2 years period that I was developing. And I honestly, those Justice League books where I got to draw the original characters, besides a couple that the JSA stories, which I loved, I felt like I didn't have the chops for. But I love the JLA JSA team up. It's just when you draw for Roy Thomas, there's a whole different sensibility. Roy is really the biographer of all comic book guys, so he knows a lot and he gets a lot of that in there. And if you don't know a lot of that, or if you don't really care for it, it's hard to relate to. And so he would come up with all these backstories that was like, really, Black Canary has to be this way? I can't Black Canary be Black Canary. Why does she have to be a twin daughter or whatever, da, 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 whatever he was doing? And I was just feeling, yeah. And Lynn was like, I know, we're going to get you a writer. And then Jerry decides he wants to come back to the book. But he came back with the feeling of, well, let's create new guys. And again, I had that shot. It was like, wow, I'm getting an opportunity here. But once we started talking, there was that feeling of, is this what we want to do, really? You know, can we go a little bigger than this? No, Justice League's always been cosmic, so I want to get guys more street level. And I was more, again, as a DC guy, I wanted cosmic. Right. I wanted big bruisers. I had it in my head of Superman taking on. If he had said we were going to take on Darkseid, I would have passed out, you know, because I loved Kirby stuff. And I thought, in the back of my mind, oh, it'd be so cool, Superman against Darkseid. Ooh, you know. And stop me from too much in nostalgia, because you just reminded me of the old days when I was telling how I started. Every time I tell everybody, it's to me, when I got started, it was really a thing of timing. And Dick kept saying, it was talent, kid. I didn't give you this because I just liked you. I liked you, and I knew you were a guy who was going to do the job. That's how you got the job. I knew that you cared. You were the guy in there who, day in and day out, I knew where you came from. I knew you know, and that's why you got the job. And that other guy I was telling you about, he's worked a lot, and he's done a lot. But Dick knew that, you know, you really want to do Justice League. And he knew Justice League was waiting. That was that Brave and the Bold I did was a test, which was hilarious, because I kept getting other jobs by then, and it was nuts because I had all these editors who were happy that I got the work done because I could do it fast. But I wanted to slow down and learn, and that was driving me crazy. I remember going to Dick and saying, can I come back to new talent? He goes, no, you're a working artist. New talent's beginners. He goes, yeah, but I want to learn. He goes, well, you're going to learn on the job, kid. Get out there. You got a deadline. line, and that went on for 3 years. that was JLA.
But then you transitioned out of comics, right? More into the animation side. What brought that on?
Honestly, it came down to discouragement. After the JLA, after we created Vibe, the Detroit League, it didn't come off the way I wanted it to, and it wasn't as strong as I wanted it to be. And I felt I wasn't as strong as I wanted to be. I took a lot of personal discouragement, which I didn't show a lot of people because I kept trying to work in comics. I did other books. I mean, Marv gave me a couple. I did like 4 or 5 Teen Titans that I enjoyed. It's just that people kept using me as a fill-in, and I wasn't getting, no one would walk it up and say, hey, we want you to take over Blue Beetle, or hey, we're creating a book. Lynn brought up Flash. We were going to revive Flash in a whole different direction, and that didn't happen. And then he had another character he wanted me to do, and that didn't happen. So it was like, you know, I was all these stillborn things happening. I went over to Marvel and got a great little pitch from Jim Shooter, who gave me a shot at doing Hulk. But they wanted me to do it more or less like Todd, and I wasn't a big fan of his work then. Right. And I just felt like I got to do a Daredevil, and I wasn't happy how that turned out. And I just felt, you know, this is the job I wanted all my life. And maybe right now this isn't working out. And by that time I moved out here, and I had a lot of friends who were getting into animation. And we're all going nuts, going, you believe how much they're paying us to do this? Come on! And, you know, my ex-roommate, Sean McManus, had joined Marvel Animation, and he sort of went, you know, I want to get back into comics. Could you take my place over here? And I went, sure, I'll do it. And I got in there and found that it was a lot easier. It was a lot more fun. And I'll stop this. This is a very interesting story. My first time at Marvel Animation, they put me in an office with this guy, crazy old guy, who was like, so, kid, I'm this big, big, giant white guy. I mean, he was big, white hair and everything. White hair, white shirt. And he goes, so I heard you draw comics, kid. I goes, yeah. I didn't know his name at the time. Dumb me. And he goes, yeah, I used to draw comics. I goes, yeah, you did? He goes, yeah, I used to draw Justice League. I goes, no, you didn't. He goes, yeah, I did. I did. You probably never even read my books. My name is Mike Sikowski. I dropped on the floor.
Wow.
And was basically bowing to him, which made him just love me more and talked down, even further down to me, which was all right because this was the guy.
Right, a legend.
And I was like, dude, I just call him dude, so, you know, sir. And he goes, oh, why you call me sir? Mike. It's like, Mike, you're the guy. I read every freaking comic of yours. Your Justice League was the Justice League that inspired me. He goes, no, it wasn't. Because he'll give me tests. And I go, okay, I'll tell you the book of yours that I liked that you drew that nobody else liked. He goes, what was it? Manhunter 2070. Sit down, kid. I got stories to tell you. So the next 6 months, I shared a studio office with him because he was doing backgrounds. And that's the sad part. This was the guy who was, before Kirby came there, he was the quintessential DC artist who drew everything. From Wonder Woman to Justice League, this man drew it. And designed a redesigned Wonder Woman when she lost her powers. That was Mike Sikowski. And here he was now at Marvel Animation to end off his pension, drawing backgrounds and prop designs, and happy about it because he was making more than he would have made in comics. He couldn't draw comics anymore. But, you know, there was a part of me that felt sad, and there was a part that felt very, very, again, gracious that I had just left comics, and I'm telling him about it, and he's like, yeah, that's how it works, yeah. And that made me feel good, like, okay, I wasn't singled out. And he goes, no, kid, what do you think we're all here for? Russ Heath is down the hall, that is down the hall. Russ Nestor Redondo is over there, and Alfredo Alcala. All these guys I read were down the hall in the office, and I'm like, wow, what a, this is like a hell of a purgatory we're in. You know, and Mike would tell me these great stories about being at DC, and it just validated a lot of what I knew I was going through, and also told me that, you know, it was good to diversify. Getting an animation wasn't, I got an animation thinking I was in exile, and I got an animation that gave me a second shot of life. And I stayed in it, and by that time, I had moved on to other studios. Long story short, Mike developed cancer. I think it was cancer. He passed away. But again, I would never, ever forget having that moment. That was like, I mean, to this day, it was just, the look on his face when he realized I generally, not only knew him, but I loved him, was nuts. He would come in and give me art, and which I wish I could. Most of the stuff was stolen out of my storage years ago, but I had original Mike Sikowski art. Then he'll come in one day and go, hey, you might like this. Oh my God, it's a Manhunter panel, you know? Yeah, I had it around, you know? And he'll tell me stories about certain people, and because I was a diehard old school DC guy, and then this is like your ancestor coming back and telling you how it works. And so I didn't miss comics for a while. And I stayed in animation, and I started working for one studio where I became a development artist for them because of my comic background. I was the guy that could sit there and tell them why Bruce Wayne really didn't exist and Batman is Batman. You know, I can tell them why this happened, that happened. And eventually I went from being a designer to I developed their shows, visually their shows. I would do these concept drawings for them in a superhero style sometimes. And that led to me helping to co-create Captain Planet. And which most people don't know, I was one of the guys behind that. And that my reward for that was I was moved from being an art director to a director. And I took over Swamp Thing, which was probably the worst animated version of anything ever done besides Swamp Thing. It was worse, it was awful. But it was me cutting my teeth on things. And all the lessons I learned from working with Lynn and Marv came in when I started working with story editors. And as a director, bringing, I always loved film. I absorbed film as a kid. And that, I think, influenced a lot of my comic book work. So here is kind of full circle where I'm now working towards sort of film, and I'm using those sensibilities. And my comic sensibilities will show me about, okay, why we set up a shot, why we compose a shot. And that, it was nice. And so I started directing, and started becoming a director on several shows, from G.I. Joe to, I tried comedy for a while. I did Macaulay Culkin's first show, first and only show, thank God. That was a bad experiment that was over with. I actually helped co-create the New Kids on the Block show, which I don't usually take credit for, but I thought it was funny because I remember telling them, you know, I don't care about New Kids on the Block, but I want this to be treated like Archie. I loved Archie. I thought Archie was a brilliant idea. So that's how I approached the New Kids on the Block by designing them. I was looking at Archie comics and going, okay, let's go with this. Luckily, I just got to design it so I can walk away from it. I didn't want to deal with it. But I did a lot of action adventure shows and stayed in animation. The high point for me in animation was when we had got a job from LucasArts. And this was before Lucas really wanted to come back and do Star Wars. But he's been hemming and hawing. And so LucasArts went, well, we got to keep the name going. So we want to develop this property we have into a show, which we did. It was called Defenders of Dinotron City. And it was created by the guys who created Sam and Max. And so everyone was really high on it. And George was sort of... It's funny, I think that's what pushed him to get back into Star Wars, because he kept going, this is all I can do, I'd rather go back to Star Wars. So he created Shadows of the Empire, which revamped Star Wars, and that's because he didn't want to do Defenders of Dinotron City, which we had done, and Fox loved it, but they decided to go with this other show that was known called X-Men. So we lost out, but I really enjoyed putting that show together, and that led me into going, all right, I want to do higher things. Long story short, I got on to Spawn, and of all the animated things I worked on, Spawn's I'm most proudest of. That was everything I ever wanted to do, and also it broke new ground. That's always, I always wanted to go somewhere where no one else is gone. Right. So we got to do a real adult anime, dark piece based on a character that in comics I wasn't a big fan of, but I eventually fallen in love with Spawn as a cinema piece. It was fun to do. I know we did a better job than the movie. Because I remember talking to John Leguizamo at the Emmys, and he was like, I want to work on your Spawn. And we were like, shh, don't say that. but he was really, I mean, we had fans like that. John Leguizamo going, I watched the show. You guys are awesome. And that really it really hit me. That really, like, wow, this is the stuff I want to do. I always had comics in my heart. I still, in my back of my mind, I used to threaten the crew, I'm going to leave animation, go back to comics. It never really came out that way. It may happen eventually, but, you know, I know comics is always going to be in my heart. But animation basically, I don't want to say saved my life, but I came out of comics feeling like I had failed and gotten animation and where I've done very well. And that's been nice.
I feel like it's, I mean, I love your comic work, but
thank you.
You mentioned some of these shows you work in. I'm like, man, that's really where you belong.
Can you
look back at you're so hard on yourself.
Yeah.
Those early. Can you look back on it now with your experience of years and have more of appreciation?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny because I did a Vibe short for DC. It was DC Nation animated short, and that's what brought my love back to Vibe, because the director and I were talking, and he was a big comic book fan, a big JLA fan. In fact, he was probably of all the professionals I've ever met, the only guy that loved the Detroit League. And we worked on Brave and the Bold together. And I was his board guy, and he would go on. He would come to me and go, "One day we're gonna do a Vibe thing." It was, "Yeah, sure, yeah, you know, yeah, sure, you go ahead, young man." And one day he calls up and goes, "We got it. We got the money. We're gonna do a short." And I goes, "Well, I don't know, man. I, you know, this has always been a sore spot. We talked about this, and I'm glad that you guys loved it, but it was," he goes, "Well, I tell you what, if you were to do it, how would you do it?" I goes, "Well, we should have fun with it." Because the problem we had drawing Vibe was that I really couldn't, you can't pull off breakdancing in comics.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard. He goes, "Well, we really got to make it a breakdancing thing." I goes, "You know what we should do? If we made this like an 80s cartoon, really feel like an 80s cartoon with the bad music and the bad animation and everything, like we got the joke, I think it'd be fun." He goes, "Guess what? That's how we're going to do it." And I went, "Okay." He goes, "I want you to design it, board it, do the character." Oh, okay. And I did. And it was a blast. It was fun. I got all this videotape of actual dancing from MC Hammer to Korean B-Boy, and we put all that in his dance moves, and it animated great. And it was supposed to only be like a minute, and all of a sudden we had a little bit more story than we thought, and they made it a two-parter, which was stupid because it was like, "What, this is two-part this?" And they did. And I remember Ben Jones was the director. Ben calls me up and goes, "Guess what? DC didn't want us to do it." They're like, "Why are you doing Vibe? And we put our foot down. "Well, we want to, because this is animation and it looks like fun." And so we did it, and they saw it, and they went, and Jeff Johns called up and go, "Hey guys, we're gonna bring back Vibe. That was cool. You proved to me you could take a dumb character." He said, "In fact, I don't even think he's dumb. I just think it's been done wrong." And now the fun part is no one's talked to me about it, which is fine. You know, it's like, I walked off. But I hear DC's bringing back Vaughn. That's Vibe. And I see it, and I have to admit it, I like what was being done. It was everything, because that was the thing. I got tired of people jumping on it and hating it. And I thought, isn't anybody going to stand up and try to make it better? I didn't think I was ready for it, obviously. I was more interested in having fun with it and even laughing with it. But to have someone come in, I forgot the writer's name, I think it was Greg Berlini, who really had a good take on it. And I thought, that's the way to play it. And then Flash picked it up as a character. And what they did on the Flash really made me fall in love with the character again. I really loved him. He was, the way they played him as this, you know, this sort of street level Tony Stark geek kid,
yeah,
that you laughed with and not laughed at. And I liked that. And I liked the actor who did it. And I thought, that's cool. That will now, if Vibe is remembered by him, I'm happy with that. But we're lucky we can have both, because the show started incorporating little things about him. You know, the Vibe goggles and the Vibe power. They haven't gone to the dancing. You don't need to.
Right.
To me, I honestly did not like the whole idea of dancing. Jerry loved Electric Boogaloo. I've always thought it was heinous. I thought it was the worst thing ever put on film. And still do. I watched it recently. Oh my God, this is awful. And I never wanted him to the whole breakdancing thing. I really wanted him to be a superhero. I wanted him to be this. I mean, I helped create him so that, you know, Kids of color had a hero. I should have made them black, but Jerry wanted a gang member. I didn't know black gang members. Gangs didn't work the way Jerry was thinking. Right. He made it more West Side Story, and I was thinking Boys in the Hood. Right. So I'm thinking, even in Detroit, that's how it is. But I didn't want to push that. I really wanted him, again, if we can go back in time, I would have said, hey, let's make him some geek kid who's ostracized, and he gets his power. And he picks up. But then, on the other hand, knowing Jerry, he's done that with Spider-Man, so I can see why he went the way he went. He didn't want to write another Spider-Man. And to give the guys in Flash, he's not like that either. He stands out original, and that's, I'm very happy. It's funny when you see your child kind of outgrow your own vision, and that's kind of cool. You know, maybe animation prepared me for that, because we work on so many properties where, you know, I like taking over Turtles. When I took over Turtles, I was specifically told we did not want to do the Cowabunga Pizza, happy-go-lucky guys. We wanted it closer to the cartoons, or to the comics, and less the cartoons. And I was, yeah, I'm with you on that. I like the original idea of the cartoons.
Yeah, a little darker than
most. Yeah, yeah. I'm used to dark. I mean, Spawn, you know? It's like, once you do Spawn, it's like, yeah, that's your alley, man. That's your neighborhood. We know the dark territory. I've argued with a lot of people. You can't tell me anything about dark noir when I have to Spawn, man. I've done all that. So with Turtles, it was like, yeah, I want to make it real ninjas. And I goes, yeah, and I was using this as the rally call to the team. But yeah, we're not talking this. We're not talking silly ninjas. We're not talking. Shokasigi ninjas. We're going Sonny Chiba ninjas. Okay, we're going Japanese television ninjas. We're going those real ninjas. And I made everybody watch Shaw Brother movies and things, ninja movies of that sort, so we can get that edge. This is what ninjas are, and I really wanted that samurai feeling to it. I really wanted to feel, take it seriously. And although we had to put in the cowabunga stuff, it was always a running joke that, you know, only Mikey would do it, and the other turtles would go, hey, we don't do that anymore. We don't do that. And that was our running joke. You know, Mikey would start going, cowabunga, dude, shut up! You know, it was usually Raph the one hitting him, and that was cool. And I like to think that we took a lot. I mean, I was inspired by the first live-action movie, as well as, again, from all these, you know, martial art films that I've immersed in, whether they were real Japanese ninja films or the Sonny Chiba, more or less B movies. I love those, and that's what I wanted us to have, that feeling. And I think we did. And when I look at the new Turtles, I see the same thing we did, and that was really cool that we were able to whether it's from the movies or to the series, that we were the ones that started that in 2003, and I'm really proud of that. So that's you know, when you say for film, I guess I have. I got to be a filmmaker, and that's gratifying. I still feel like I'm a comic artist. That's how I used to tell everybody. I'm a comic artist masquerading as an animator. I really don't know anything about animation. My animation timing stinks. My editor cracks me up. My old editor used to crack up because he was like, you know, dude, you got like 10 seconds in this. That's long. You know, 3 seconds is almost too long. Animation. So if you want me to sit down with a stopwatch and the whole, I'm not the guy. But you want me to sit there and tell you how it should move and how it should look, I know exactly how it works. And in the show Cooler Party that you heard us talking about, that was what I did. It was that, you know, Tad had it going a little too fluffy round, and I wanted to bring it back to this is a fantasy world. This is on the level of Lord of the Rings. And, you know, although these characters are laughing at the beginning of the story, by the end of it is a huge saga where these Kulapari are like frog samurai. And I want it, when they show up, we get this impression they're superheroes. You can't have them jumping around like a bunch of goofballs. They got to be serious. And there's an edge here, and kids can respond to that. I mean, this was based on a young adult novel that was created, and I read a lot of those, and a lot of these are very, very dark, very edgy. Whether they're from Hunger Games or Divergent, you know, that's why they're big, because they kind of walk a fine line between, you know, what kids can relate to and what they're afraid of ahead.
Right.
And I want that same feeling in this anime, in this cartoon, and that's what that's how the show has been sold. It's been doing well for that.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the things, and one of the reasons I think that the Detroit League gets love now, you know, now that time's gone by and people can look back on it, because it did have, it was something new. It wasn't the same old.
It was actually, I mean, I thought we were very ambitious. I mean, that if I had to go back in time and say, okay, you did something right, and you're right, I mean, I'm a lot harder on myself about it, but I admire that we tried. I mean, I'm never going to apologize for moving him to Detroit. I grew up, that was my hometown. It's still depressing. I have family still there. And it's depressing how it's become compared to when I was a kid. But the spirit of the people there are amazing. In fact, when I tell people, you know, all you hear about Detroit is the crime and the blight. What you don't hear is the art resurgence, the amazing art that is there, and the music and the art, which has always been there. It's amazing. I mean, it's one of the most trip-hop music, electronic music, owe a lot to the Detroit scene at this point. There's a lot of young artists coming up in many medias, including comics, that are coming from Detroit that I've met and seen and talked to. And I'm just amazed. And so using Detroit as this base, I think was a brilliant idea. I mean, the whole company idea, when we were sitting there talking about it, everybody wanted to become more grounded. And I did kind of respond to that. I mean, as much as I wanted to stay cosmic, there was another feeling of going, you know, but I do understand that. You know, I mean, Daredevil was being hot at the time.
Right.
And X-Men had a certain feeling of that. And to me, that was the guys we were looking at. Teen Titans certainly had a little bit of that, a lot of that. Even with the Trigon stuff, it was still grounded. And so Justice League going in that direction, ambitious. I think it was very smart. I think that it was a reason why everybody held back from it, because, you know, how many times could we do the same trick over and over again? Actually, I got that from Mike Sikowski. I mean, when I was talking to Sikowski, his feeling was, I like, you know, his Justice League were guys hiding in a mountain. So I told him what I did, and I was expecting him to go, ah, that was awful. He was like going, oh, that's pretty cool. I kind of like the idea of that. They're in a city, they got a warehouse. I'm like, wow, Mike likes it?
Something different.
Yeah, and so I think that in the long run, what we tried to do, it was necessary. And I think it opened the doors. To do it over again, I think if we went more along the line of a Vixen, if we stayed on that level of taking her seriously. Gypsy never really came together for me. I never wanted her to be Kitty Pryde. I think everybody kind of expect her to be Kitty Pryde. She certainly wasn't, but we never found her. Vibe, I think, as they went along, because I would peek on the show and look at the book, I mean, and see what was going on. And I feel for Luke McDonald. I think he did he carried the ball well. But it never found itself. It never really. And then later I thought, well, maybe we took it too seriously. I think, again, it needed that fun. It needed, and I mean fun in that it really needed what I saw in Titans. Titans, for all seriousness, never let you forget it was a superhero book. Justice League kept apologizing being a superhero book for a long time until, I mean, it's like, instead of letting Vi be a hero, they kept going on about, why are you a Justice League? Why don't you just let him fight a monster and kick the monster's ass? Now you know why he's a Justice League member. That's what we want. That's what should have been done. And we, you know, it was, for whatever reasons, it never came together for me. And I didn't see it. And honestly, I was too young to assert any kind of control over that. And it's probably good. I didn't know enough. I think I really started learning more when I got in animation. When I was behind the scenes working on shows, and I learned why things worked the way they worked and how you broke down the story, and then I got it, how to put things together. And I wish I had those chops when I was doing Justice League, because then I know how to do this now. I know how we should do this. We could have really made this fun. And I tried to give them gadgets and things that didn't quite take off, and I didn't know how to introduce him, and Jerry wasn't interested in writing about him, so, you know, I tried to give him a particular type of jet. I wanted them to have their own version of a Quinjet. That was hard to get across. The Dale Gunn character, I wanted to be like their, I didn't want a Snapper Carr, but I always felt like Justice League needed a human guy because of Snapper Carr.
They need perspective.
Yeah, but I wanted someone who would be more support, more, But I wanted them to have a Tony Stark without them being a Tony Stark. They're gadget guy. So that's when I created Gale Gunn. The fact he looked like me was probably a little too coincidental. Maybe I should have made him a little different, you know. I was doing everything I could to find a spark in that book, and it, you know, knowing what I know now, I think, again, I would have known how to play with it more. But I think the original ideas, everything we tried to do was, you're right, I think it was pretty good. I think it was a novel idea.
I think it stands the test of time. It's one of my favorite Justice League eras.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it's hard to not draw Justice League and not look at the different books. And later on, of course, when J.M. DeMatteis and, I can't think of his name now.
Keith Giffen
and McGuire took over the book. It was apropos what they did, absolutely. And all the ones have worked for me after that. And again, I think that the funny part about it, none of it would have happened if it weren't for Detroit, the JLA Detroit. Really wouldn't have. I don't think they would have taken that chance to bring in humor and odder characters like, you know, Ice and Crimson Fox and odd characters like that if they didn't have a Vixen or a Gypsy and a Vibe. And I never liked Booster Gold. I'll say that out loud. I never liked Booster Gold. But, you know, again, if you could open the doors for Booster Gold, Vibe was the guy who was the key. He was the door master. He got the door open. And I thought that was cool. It felt, I love that thing of, again, Justice League was all the DC's heroes. And we were given the edict we couldn't use them. And so by doing what we did, we opened the door where we have to use. You've got to bring in these guys. You've got to bring in. I would have loved if someone said, in fact, drawing Metamorpho, I remember clearly when we were throwing out names of people to put in there, I wanted to put in Metamorpho. I always loved this guy. This guy was always fun to me. The idea that he's an Indiana Jones character, kind of a hardboiled guy who's now been, you know, twisted and changed into this guy, and he sort of finds his way to deal with it, you know, because he's already been around the world. So, and he's, to me, a street level. He's more worldly level than the other guys because he's been to the Yucatan. He's been to Egypt. He's done this. And now he has this power. It doesn't, and it's a power of a god. He doesn't think of himself as a god. He's still, hey, I date a millionaire, you know, and I'm a badass. That's all I care about. And I wanted a guy like that. To me, he would have been our Green Arrow, who was the more down worldly guy. I wanted a guy like Metamorpho. But I think, he was grabbed by the Outsiders. So we were screwed. You know? So, but I love to bring guys like that. We're talking to Sikowski. Again, we cracked him up. He's like, kid, don't you like anybody new? He goes, no, I wanted Wanda Beast. I love Wanda Beast. Mike created my Wanda Beast. I love that. I would have loved, if we could have figured out how to make Wanda Beast work for JLA, I would have loved him in there. Again, I thought DC's always had this great pantheon of characters that we could use. And by the time we're doing Justice League Detroit, we were stuck with the edict we couldn't use them. But again, because of Justice League Detroit, JLA opened up to international and everybody and their mother.
Yeah.
So in the long run, it's like, all right, we served a purpose. We did something good. And in the long run, I've fallen in love with the characters again. Although, again, Gypsy is really hard to, to this day, I sit there and go, what could I have done? I don't know. Gypsy was just a hard character to get across.
Yeah, like you said, I think she just never really came together.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah, you know, it drives me nuts as a creator. You sit there and go, when you work with Neil Adams, you always remember that adage, him going, there's no such thing as a bad character. And so in my mind, it's like, I know we could have, there's something about Gypsy we just missed. And if we had found that, I would have liked to play that up. I love the idea we wanted her mysterious. She pops in and out. It's just that we made her just almost maybe a little too literally mysterious. But I love what we did with Vixen. Vixen was great. Steel, I like the backstory of Steel. I wished we had got away from the whole making him look like his grandfather. I think we could have been a little more audacious. I look at books like Infinity Inc. and that blew me away. I remember seeing Jerry Conway, the artist. I guess art in my head, and my name escapes me. Jerry Ordway.
Ordway, yeah.
Ordway is just magnificent. And I remember when he approached those characters and thought, God, he got to make them superheroes. That's cool. You know, I like Obsidian. I like, you know, all these guys. And I thought, that's the way I wish we could have thrust for that. But again, shoulda, woulda, coulda. It's been over and done with. It was interesting to have books pop up like that. And you looked at it and went, they had something. So what are we missing? And it was hard. So obviously it still bothers me this day that I look at that and go, I'm gratified how many people, and I get a ton of people now coming to me and say how much they like JLA Detroit. It blows me away. I really gotta be honest. I really wish I heard this back then. I probably wouldn't have left comics, but I didn't hear that. I heard the negative stuff, so I didn't hear the positive stuff.
Well, everything happens for a reason, Jack.
It does. And I'm very proud of it. So, I mean, I'm not apologetic in that respect.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you for letting me run on.
if some of our listeners want to take a look at your art or find out what you're up to these days, what's the best way to get the info?
ChuckPattonArt.com is my website. I'm trying to update it more often. I'm also trying to blog. I'm going to start blogging sometime in the next couple months of things I'm going to be doing. You can certainly get a hold of me through ChuckPattonArt.com. I take commissions as well as every once in a while I get chats of people saying, "Hey, can I talk to you about things? Can I interview you?" And that's been great. It's been fun to be able to reminisce. So thank you for bringing this up.
Oh, sure, my pleasure.
It's been fun.